majority. That's good.
Good.
Okay. Let's see where we are. This is Donato Bramante. He started life as an assistant to Piero della Francesca in Urbino. Basically, you could say he was originally a painter. His first work was in a sense, a conceptual drawing, which we might call today a diagram, in that it was an invention, which is this plate over here. That's all that was given. From that plate, these drawings were made, which describe the possibility of a plan as notated in and a section as notated in this particular etching. I think that what's important about Bramante is that he moves from the idea of the relationship between the subject and the object in Brunelleschi, the idea of representation and the creation of history in Alberti. He wants to then find clearly something of his own and of his own moment in time. And what he does, I think for the first time, is return architecture to a condition that the signs refer inward rather than outward, toward the, as it were, the inner conceptual structure of the work, and to present that inner structure to in the work, so that while he may be doing a church or a series of churches, he's exploring the possibility of the internal relationships between what architecture has, that is structure, which is presence, which is mass, and void, which is the space, as it were, formed by the structure and the mass. And what's important, I think, to notice about this drawing, first of all, it's what can be called a nine square, in the sense that it has diagrammatically an organization of nine, but what's interesting about the nine, geometrically they describe, because of the relationship of not only the structure to the edges, but the relationship of the space to the surrounding spaces. So that instead of being a series of layers that we saw in Brunelleschi and Alberti, we have a centralized scheme where the space in the center is in fact larger than the space here or here. In other words, there is an, if we call this a C space, we can call this a B space because of the fact that the width is not the same. But then, if this is a B, this is certainly a C here, and therefore the corners take on four D's. So there are four different proportional relationships in the spaces which give them their own identity and their own relationship. In other words, it's not so much that the proportions, that this is proportionally related to this or this to this, but that they are contiguous spaces, adjacent spaces, that are proportioned differently. And that you are aware as you walk in these spaces that the space is changes. So we don't have either a progression down the center or a series of layers this way, but in fact we have a composition that radiates out from a center. And of course the dome over the center, as you can see, is here, is very different than the arches and the half domes over the side aisles or these two bays here. What's also interesting is the play between the apse here and what would be a transept here in the traditional church condition. But in fact, the transept could be said to be here, and so that the apse is in a sense taken away from the transept crossing by another bay over here. But as even stranger about this organization, the main obelisk, in other words, the kind of element that is used and was used by the popes to place in significant spaces in Rome to relate the connections between one church and another through piazzas that had obelisks which marked them. So that the obelisk is a very important conceptual element in the 16th century in Rome, and will become so after Bramante in the later plan in the 1560s and 70s. But in any case, what's interesting is that the obelisk shown here is in fact not in the center bay. It's shifted off of the center bay. So there is a play between the center, the apse here with its statuary, and the obelisk. And there's very little of this that has any kind of religious denomination to it. It is clearly a church structure, but it has very little in the way of church iconography. And in fact, that is purposeful to in fact set up the idea of the architecture as a series of related, what I would call organic parts. And I would say that it is the first condition of an architecture that one would call not so much organic as an organism. That is, the relationship of parts to each other rather than to some symbolic entity, i.e. to a god, or to the human subject, as in Brunelleschi's organization of space perspectivally. Now, clearly there is a perspectival condition, and if you look at this perspective, it's clear that he learned perspective from Piero della Francesca. It's very close to Piero's drawing. But he also learned about, from being in Urbino and being at the Ducal Palace in Urbino, the question of how one deals with the idea of corner. And the idea of corner becomes very important to Bramante. So what you have is the pillars are all, as it were, cruciforms. They are blunted cruciforms. They are not the same dimension in this dimension as this dimension, but they all have these cutouts at the corners so that, in fact, you can read the space here as cutting out of the solid, that is, allowing for its full quadrant to take place. So the columns don't chop off the spaces, but in fact you get a full cubic volume here, you get a space or a gasket in between, and then a full cubic volume here. And this is the first play that Bramante has with Poche. In other words, using the solid to define a relationship of spaces which are not necessarily related to one another by a contiguity, but through a series of slices between them marked by the columnar grid. And so what you have is a, first of all, an organic relationship of parts to the whole. The nine are not equal. They take their space and size from their position in the nine. And then you have this dislocation here, playing with this dislocation here from the dome space. And so what you have is a symmetry here about this center, which is very clear. Then you have the elongation or the absent here, and you have the disturbance by the displacement of the obelisk to off the center. This is a very important moment because I think Bramante is, for me, sometimes people talk about him as the beginning of a modern way of thinking about the organization of space, that is, as an organism. He's also could be thought to be what one could call a degree zero of architecture at that moment. In other words, everything moves from Brunelleschi through Alberti to Bramante. Bramante establishes the terms for a what one would say is a classical organism. In other words, that does not necessarily refer to the past, but uses elements in the past in a new structured relationship that relates internally to one another rather than to some external symbolism to the subject, etc. So for me, it's the first condition of an organism. Number two, it's the first condition after the movement to an immanent metaphysic of an organism which has an autonomy, an internal autonomy. And number three, one which does not refer outward to some symbolic past. Next, please. Now, this is the second project that Bramante does, and you begin to see, this is the church, the cathedral in Pavia, and you see, first of all, a sense of Brunelleschi's Santo Spirito in the sort of marching of the side chapels, but notice how interrupted they are by structure. So there is a very definite poche that enters into the space, which interrupts the continuous rhythm that Brunelleschi introduced in Santo Spirito. But one of the more unique elements in what Bramante does, in taking, as it were, a Gothic structure and turning it into something else. And that is the deployment of the relationship of the apse, the apse here, to the transept, to the nave. And he makes, as it were, again, a centralized scheme out of this part of the church. First of all, he takes and makes the poche of these columns such that they create a circular, or at least an octagonal sort of crossing here. And radiating out from that octagonal crossing is a series, these are very much like the side chapels in the transept at Santo Spirito, but with a great difference. He interrupts that continuity with a half-round deeper chapel here, which begins to relate, though these become inner spaces here, to a series of external chapels, which are also octagonal and have octagonal thrusting out from them. But the interesting thing also is that so that what you get here is a proto St. Peter's, in other words, a centralized church about a series of elements which all concatenate in scale and in space to relate to this center. And so you can see the movement from the Previdari etching to the cathedral in Pavia. Also, what is important to note are these trapped spaces here, what one would call interstitial spaces, or they will become poche in St. Peter's, where they become filled in. In other words, in order to get this figure and to get this figure on the inside, you're going to have something in between. And Bramante is not worried about this sort of leftover interstitial space or poche, because it's necessary for his idea of this relationship of the, in a sense, nine squares. So what you have is a small space, a larger space here, and a small space, which is then further subdivided into nine further squares, and then into an octagonal form. So you have, in a sense, octagons playing with nines, eights and nines, playing spatially in a very dynamic concatenation of relationships. And for me, Pavia marks an enormous change from the Gothic spaces of there's no question that Santo Spirito and San Lorenzo are very interesting churches, but they are nothing in terms of the dynamic relationships of parts to the whole and geometric relationships, that is, nine squares to octagons and these kinds of things until you see Pavia. Now, what is important for you all is to be able not to listen to the words so much that I say, but be able to look and see the difference between this organization of space and, say, San Lorenzo or Santo Spirito, and to be able to conceptually draw the difference. In other words, what if you had to say, look, here's the organization of Pavia, here's the organization of Santo Spirito, how would you draw it in a very, in other words, concise manner to explain the idea. That's what I'm going to trying to get you all to do, is to relate what you see to the artifacts, and then what you're able to draw. And if I were to ask you to draw the relationship, the differences between Santo Spirito and Pavia, you wouldn't go and set the damn thing up on your computer. You know, I'd want it done in a minute or 2 minutes, and you'd have to be able to draw with your hand and your eye and your mind. That's what's going to allow you to make architecture 10 years from now. In other words, that facility of understanding how to draw quickly the ideas in someone else's projects, you'll begin to be able to draw ideas in your own projects. That's very important to understand. It's not important what the date of this church is, what was the date of the restoration, who held Bramante. All of that is art history. I'm talking about architecture, being able to look at this and see those different relationships and how they're deployed. That's why we look at these pictures. May I have the next, please? Okay. This is another of Bramante's churches. It's in Milano, and it's called San Satiro. And what Bramante did was to take an existing church in a very tiny location and put in this altarpiece area. In other words, because he couldn't extend the church out this way, he had to find some way to, in fact, create an apse without having an apse. And then he went to his mentor, Piero della Francesca, who painted perspectival vaults and spaces. And what he did was create Bramante in this depth here, this painted architecture, so that he created a sense of depth where there was no depth. Of course, this is what Peruzzi does in Rome. This is what Palladio later does at the Teatro Olimpico. And so that what he does is take something that's literally compressed, literally doesn't exist as space, and try and make it spatial. Now, what's interesting, I was in Milan 2 years ago, and I ran across a group of trustees from the Museum of Modern Art, and they said to me, these are all sort of art groupies, what should we see in Milan? I said, well, one of the most important things is to see San Satiro. And they said, oh, where is that? And I told them where it was. And they said, oh, we'll go. And they went into San Satiro. I believe they entered somewhere, either over here or over here. I can't remember how they went. They came in either this way or this way. And instead of looking left, they looked right. And they didn't see anything. And they came back and said, what were we supposed to see there? And I said, what about the false perspective of the altar? Huh? We didn't see that. And I said, well, that was the whole reason to go. So even when you send somebody to see something and point them, you have to go there and put their nose right in it or they'll miss it. So just to say, when you go to San Satiro, make sure that you turn left. Next, please. And, of course, Here you see where what Bramante does with that false perspective. You can see the kind of ridging here back in this depth to create the idea of the false perspective. Of course, here is the sight lines that he used to do this. So Bramante is very interested in the internal possibilities of architecture to be both spatial and planar, both mass and void, which I believe are the, as it were, parts of the organism that make up any architecture. Not their literal presence, but their articulating their conceptual presence, that is, something other than their literal being. Okay, can I have the next, please? This is the famous San Pietro in Montorio by Bramante, and of course what is interesting about this project is first of all, this was the plan that Bramante drew, and again we have this play between a circle, let's say, and an octagon, and we have to look at the different scales and the relationship of solid to void. Here we have for the first time a series of chapels which are cut out of a poche, and you get an irregular poche so that it's hard to read structure. All you can read is like a Swiss cheese, like somebody ate into the solid to produce this kind of organization. What's interesting is that there is a clear movement in scale, and I think you have to notice how this organism relates the idea of an internal scale to the parts, okay? Because look at the scale of this poche here, these columns here, then these columns here, and this poche here. So this is a kind of echo of this, the same kind of diagonal axes, and the diagonal is going to become very important to Bramante in both St. Peter's and Santa Maria della Pace. That is, the fact that the diagonal becomes the dominant axial condition. Because if you look here, here are the orthogonal axes, like this. But they are played in sort of sotto voce, a sort of soft, low voice, compared to the diagonal axes of the other chapels. And inserting the diagonal as a dynamic axial relationship in the space starts to get the space pinwheeling and pivoting it around. So it creates an instability in the space. And it's very important to realize how diagonals operate. I mean, Lou Kahn, for all his life, played in his poche the play of the diagonal against the orthogonal. And so here we have the diagonal as a dynamic introduction into the space, to the sort of play between scales, which Palladio next week will pick up, and you have to be very conscious of the play of scales in Redentore and San Giorgio Maggiore, between a giant order and a less of an order, a smaller order. And then when you examine what was actually built, it's really interesting to see the play what the actual koshay looks like. I mean, these are really interesting. You get these half-round niches, which play with the voids over here against the circular columns. But if you will notice, all of these pieces are variegated in such a way to produce, while they produce a regular condition of half-round, and opening here, they also give you the diagonals through, and they give you a series of other elements here on the orthogonals about an altar here. So we get both the orthogonal axes, the diagonal axes, and an internal structuring of the poche, as well as an external. You can see that in here, where there's an internal order that plays against an external order, an internal order here, which plays against an external order, so that what you have in Bramante for the first time is what I would call a dynamic poche, where the two sides do not necessarily relate what's on either side to one another, but set up a series of differences, both in scale and in ordination. So this is really important to look at, that you see here is a corner which makes an internal situation, and here is this part of this poche is related to a continuous A relationship. And that's very important to note, that you would not know from being out here what was going to happen inside. So that the play between an orthogonal relationship here, a drum in the center, and a series of diagonal axes, that is three organizational conditions, an orthogonal, a drum, and a dynamic diagonal, are not necessarily apparent as you are approaching the space, in other words. And then the disjunction between the two, causing an organism that depends on disjunction. In other words, you have to read this thing as not an ABCBA, that is a symmetry, but as a series of relational parts which set up a very intriguing dynamic. So again, Bramante begins to break down the classic perceptions of relationships of parts to a whole. There are parts to a whole, but they are set in a very different context. Next. We have here, I think, the three different corner possibilities that I want to talk about. First of all, on the right is the very famous palazzo and courtyard of the Ducal Palace in Urbino by Lorenzo Lorana. And this is something that Bramante would have seen. And what you notice here is the articulation of the corner. And what this articulation does is the following. You see that you have a column that finishes this side here, and a column that finishes this side over here, and a slot in the middle. In other words, to articulate the fact that you have two sides, that they don't run together, which means conceptually that the space is made up of a series of additive planes, not subtracted from a pre-existing solid, but the space is formed by taking planes and flipping them up like you would a prairie house when they were constructing them. So the articulation, the idea that we get is that the space is formed by addition rather than subtraction. Whereas in Bramante, we're going to see a dialectic between space being formed by addition or subtraction. That is, the Poche reads as cutting, being cut away to reveal space, or the Poche is revealed as pushing into the space through its accretion. So here it is very clear at the Ducal Palace in Urbino that the sides are meant to be articulated. That is, they are thematized at the corner. When we return to Brunelleschi's corner at Santa Croce, the Cortile in Santa Croce, no such articulation. It just happens, you know. This thing comes over here and hits a column at the corner, which is the column from the side. So that there's no thematic articulation of the corner. Here is a thematic articulation of addition. Here there is no, and we talked about in the Pazzi Chapel, Brunelleschi was not interested in corners. Next, please. Now, here we come to this monster of Santa Maria della Pace. There's no question, if you look at the stone, the way the thing is set, that there is, you enter this space somewhere down here, not on the center. You come in at a corner. And what you immediately see is this corner, all right? And what you realize that there is a strong diagonal thrust to something which, a space which is formed in the round by an arcade, but that the diagonal corner is something that's very important. And what you realize also when you begin to look at what happens at that corner, you realize that, in fact, something strange has happened. That there has been, instead of just a diagonal from the corner, there is a vector. In other words, an axis with a thrust. And there has been a pressure on this corner. Now, first of all, what happens for the first time in the history of such courtyards is that the second story, the piano nobile, has an intermediate column which is not taken up down below. So there is a different scale of the ordination up on top. So that's one of the things that Bramante does. But it pales in terms of energy in comparison with what happens here. Here we have these engaged pilasters, fluted pilasters, flat, with flattened arches here. The flattened arch comes over, and the flattened arch comes over, and we hit the pilaster just. In other words, we get this corner here, and then the piece of the is swallowed up so that all that remains of the pilaster, which is this, is you get this piece here, you can see it, you get this piece over here, and a slot in the middle, and this little piece here, which is half of this piece of the cap and half of this piece squashed together. Now you would never see that in any classical building. You would never see that in any
ordination where there is a stable relationship of parts to a whole. But here, suddenly, we have, and why I call this organic or organism, is there's a relationship between the space and the solid which is active. In other words, it's not just solids and like in Brunelleschi, or solids as in Alberti referring to the past, but basically solids which relate to the space in an organic way, creating an organism. That is a dialectic, a dynamic dialectic between solid and void. And this can only be the result of something happening over here. Something is pressed into the space, presses into the solid. The thing is collapsed into that corner as if through some sort of suction, sucking that thing into the corner like that, because there's no other way to explain this residue, and it's purposeful. It's not like Brunelleschi, it's not like Urbino, it's not like anything that was ever seen before. Now, what I'm saying is, this is not good or bad, but it's an invention about the relationship it articulates. It is a sign of an internal relationship between solid and void. And I think that is what is, for me, the important condition of this courtyard, and also of Bramante's work. I mean, this is a, for me, a monster gesture. And now, clearly, a tourist goes in to the courtyard, if they do go into this courtyard, and they say, and they don't see anything. It's important for you all to be able to see and to get a sense when you're there, when you go, of the excitement of what that gesture does to the space. And that's why I show it to you. So, Bramante is, for me, the first one that creates an internal dialectic between the solid and void, where the void is not just passive, nor the solid passive, but they both interact in different ways on each other. Next, please. And there you can see it up close. But you also get this very strange marriage of part of the base here creating another figure. The thing that's interesting is that two elements which are fragments of another element, that is fragments of the base and the capital, form other figures not related to either a base or a capital. This is not a base figure and this is not a capital figure. And that's the genius of this particular corner. You won't find many like it. Next, please. And you can now see what that's like up close. See how it works here. The base works here at this corner at the second level. An extraordinary object. If I were to show anybody that object and say, what is it? It would be hard to know what the hell it is. that's, you know, what makes it such a work of genius. And also, notice the fact that the corners just don't come together, but there is this little articulation, right? This little protuberance that comes forward to articulate the residue, the just slight residue of both columns, or both pilasters. as the case may be. Next, please. Next. Now, here we have Bramante's St. Peter's, and then first of all, we have to go back to Da Vinci's sort of study for a centralized church. And a centralized St. Peter's. Now, what I think is different about Leonardo, and while he's a great genius, it's the notion of the circle here, or the octagonal form moving toward a circle. It repeats itself on the outside. So even though you have an irregular condition, the relationship of this to the outside is not very different. But when you compare San Pietro Montorio of Bramante to that, or the organization here of St. Peter's, the parts to the whole create a different structure. In other words, there may be an octagonal relationship here, but there's also a cruciform set in a box. There are many different geometric forms, plus the diagonal axes, so that what you have is an overlay of geometric possibilities that creates a certain, again, organicism, which I think is lacking here. This is just a series of chapels that rotate around a central space and don't necessarily give you what I would call a series of overlays that can be read in many different ways. There's no question that this drawing by Leonardo influenced Bramante, but there's also no question that Bramante was moving in this direction. And all you have to do is look at the Poche elements, right, like this, and what they form over here, this kind of space over here, as opposed to this kind of space over here, as opposed to this space over here, as opposed to this space over here. When you begin to put together this space and this space and this space and this space, you get a relationship of pieces that are both individual and have a kind of resonance and dynamic relationship to a very simple set of geometries. That's what's interesting, is that you have the square, you have the cruciform, you have these interstitial domical spaces, very much like, this is clearly Previdari, it's clearly Pavia, but at a very much more, it's also San Pietro Montorio, worked out at a very, very subtle and distinct relationship. So that what you could say is that Bramante was able to look at Pavia, he was looked at Previdari, he looked at San Pietro in Montorio, the little chapel, and he was able to then synthesize in his own work an evolution into St. Peter's. I think that's the important thing, that he was analytically conscious enough to see how he could make out of his own firmament something new. And of course, this is the kind of consciousness that I want you all eventually to be able, in other words, design is not just something, what am I going to do now? Let me look at a magazine. But to try and think of ideas and issues that elements that can be used in architecture to create an internal discourse. Mies took the column section, and if you just wanted to look at Mies van der Rohe, all you'd have to do is study the evolution of the column section in Mies as it hits the corner, from the outboard side of the corner, the inboard side of the corner, and how it inflects space. And you would understand the evolution of Mies van der Rohe. It wasn't just detailing for detailing's sake. It was detailing that evolved from a discourse of a unit, that is the column, an element of the of architecture's potential to deploy itself in various ways to transform one's idea of an inner corner, an outer corner, a space. And this is what I think Bramante does. For me, it's not, oh, these are beautiful plans, or these are great proportions, or gee, these work well. What he does is set up a concatenation between the smallest pieces and the largest pieces in scale, and they're not all turned inward, because there's an inward-looking piece, and then there's this external piece, which moves like this. So there's an in and an out, whereas in, I believe, Leonardo, there's only an in and an outer rim to that in. It doesn't turn. There's some slight turning outward, but not in the same way that Bramante does it. And I have the next. And then by the time of the later project, the pochet starts to become like almost a filigree, a kind of very light a thing which is animate in itself, starts to take on animate characteristics, not just pochet around columns, but very much like San Pietro Montorio, where you get, you don't know where the structure is, you don't know where one figure begins and ends, and it's, you know, really quite extraordinary. This particular doubling in here of the pochet, which gives you this very thin, attenuated condition of pochet, and you don't know whether it's the space that's active, pressing. It almost believed that in the first case, the solid is pushing on the space, but here it seems that the space is more dominant and has is pushing on the solid. Next, I think it's of course, and then you get these other pieces where you don't know whether looks like a total solid, rather, in a square. And again, now it's been reduced to that with indentations here. And then within it is no longer, is it a cruciform or a diagonal, but a sort of interlacing of vectors, almost nine squares. I mean, defining squares so that the pochet is left over, and you get one, two, three, one, two, three. So you get these lines with pieces coming off it so that it's constantly flipping back and forth. You don't know which is the active, whether it's the solid that's active, these figural pieces left over, or it's the voids. And for me, Bramante, this is the first architect that, in fact, is going to take solid and void and produce a dialectic where it is uncertain which is the ground and which is the figure, whether the solid is the ground for the void is the ground and the solid is the figure. And of course, this figure-ground dialectic, which is the first organicism that exists in architecture, is then going to be used by the next series of architects we look at to produce very, very different dynamical relationships between solid and void. So for me, Bramante brings things to a zero position from which Serlio and Peruzzi, San Gallo, Michelangelo, Palladio, and others will move into a fantastic period, which is often called mannerism. That is, that it's no longer following the rules or the 0 degree that Bramante set up from Alberti and Brunelleschi, but tries to distort in very strange ways, both in painting and sculpture, distort these, what one would call organic relationship. Yes?
At this point where he's completely undermined the main axes and the hierarchy of the church,
yeah,
does it still perform church function very well, as effectively as the old style would?
Well, I could say the church functions were changing, number one. Masses were coming into the churches. There was the whole question leading up to the Counter-Reformation that the church needed to change its relationship of the people receiving the Mass and communion. Does it matter? That's the question. And who is here to judge? I mean, we're in an architecture school, and what we're doing is trying to understand about architecture, not whether, I mean, nobody ever asks whether Borromini's churches perform well their functions, or Palladio's churches. Nobody ever asks whether Ronchon works as a great church, pilgrimage church for Corbeau. Who cares? It's an incredible piece of architecture. Does this building work? I hate this space, yet it's a great piece of architecture, right? It's on a stamp. Paul Rudolph was a great architect. If we were to judge by the people sitting in this room and the teacher, it's a terrible piece of architecture. But it isn't. So the question is, there's a disjunction between, we don't have any commentaries from the time that says this worked or not. What I'm trying to do is get all of you over the idea, somehow, this litany that form follows function, right? And if you get the functions right, you've got architecture. You can get the functions right and have nothing, right? I'm certain all the suburban houses that developers put up work for the people in them. They're happy. All the houses in Levittown, where these people went after the war, functioned for these people, or they wouldn't stay there. They wouldn't pay an enormous amount of money to get McMansions, right? People have, first of all, no sense to architecture. And architecture and whether the house functions or not have nothing to do with one another. You can solve the functions of a program and do no architecture for the whole of your life. The question is, what I'm trying to get you to understand is, what is architecture? Yes, you must solve functions. Yes, it must, you know, enclose, shelter, etc. But what else is there? So I'm assuming that the patrons of Bramante allowed him to move in this direction. you know, and I think the popes were more interested in their legacy than the communicants in the church. Not that that's a good or bad thing. So, what we're looking at, it looks like a great bazaar or a souk, you know, a bazaar of ecclesiastical proportions, right? where I imagine many functions could be performed at the same time. Don't forget, this is a giant scale building, and when you go there, you realize that. I can't say whether it functioned better or worse than what, you know. Because,
I mean, function aside, I guess I'm wondering, at what point can you reconceptualize the internal logic of a type to where it no longer is that type?
And suppose it wasn't. You reconceptualize the internal logic of a type. That's a good idea. You start from there, right? You're going to say, I'm going to reconceptualize the internal logic of a type, right? Until you get to Rem Koolhaas's Seattle library, where the type, no, it's still a library, but the type doesn't exist. So what's wrong with that?
I'm not saying there's anything.
No, but that's the whole idea. You just hit, if you can remember what you said, the idea of architecture is to begin with a type, to reconceptualize the type to the point where the type no longer exists. Then you've done something. If you can do that in your lifetime once, you'll be a genius. Or you would have to be a genius even to attempt to do something like that. Just remember you said that, right? What happens, you said, when you reconceptualize a type to the point where the type no longer exists? You've hit a bullseye. And if there's a motto of this class, you've just articulated. Yes?
The slide on the right here,
that's
the logic, I think, right?
Third.
Did you skip one?
No, I think that...
I was under the impression
that
the one on the right is Sangalo.
Is what?
The
Sangalo. Is what? Sangalo. Maybe. I mean, maybe it's this one that's... let's suppose it is. Okay? So let's give credit to Sangalo, who followed.
Were there two Sangalos?
What?
Were there two Sangalos?
Yes, there were. Do you know their dates?
Well, one was before Bronte.
Yes, and one is after. Right. And one of the Sangalo did the centralized church at Todi, which is the important Santa Maria della Consolazione. I don't show that, but clearly the Sangalo, the Antonio the Older, influenced Bramante. I show these because they're all either related to or like Bramante. This could be the Sangalo, and I apologize for my poor scholarship. But, sometimes it's known as the third Bramante, but maybe this is the third one. I know there are three schemes for St. Peter's, but as a crumbling architect, I don't think it's... I'm trying to get you not to worry about the facts of perception, but being able to see. Can you see the difference between this, this, and the other two? That's the important issue, right? Not who did it, when it was done, etc., but I'm trying to get you to be able to see the evolution of a dynamic internal relationship between solid and void. Any other questions? So, you guys should have been able to draw, now I'm not going to say, oh, this is not three or two or one, because whatever you guys chose, three, two, one, what I'm interested in seeing is whether you get the difference and what Tate and Neil seem to suggest is that you hit the bullseye, so let's see what happens. Let's take 10 and then we'll go on.
You know, this tape ran out. I never see it when it runs out. So.